Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Hello and welcome to the penultimate episode of Mayor of Easttown. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you are just joining us, what we like to do on this podcast is Richard and I like to pick a show that we're watching kind of closely, break it down week by week, and discuss it with you all, listen to your thoughts and theories over email, etc., and try to sort of piece together our understanding of the show. Sometimes we talk to folks who worked on the show. This week we have Mayor's number one suspect, Billy Ross himself, Robbie Tan, is on the show. So you'll be hearing from him actually kind of early in the episode. And then we'll get into the discussion of the episode. Before we get to that, before we get to poor Billy Ross, before we get to the discussion of the episode, Richard and I want to go through some emails and other contributions that we have. Richard, episode six. What emails do we have here today?
Well, most of these episodes, all of these emails are about episode five.
Of course,
as happens with any mystery show, when you near the end where things are being revealed, sometimes that renders a lot of emails obsolete, unfortunately. But we do have a couple that I think are still relevant. Certainly one of them. The first one is from Nicole. Who says, I was super bummed when we saw Jess with Dylan and the other friend and was super suspicious when they stole Aaron's journals. However, I think Dylan is trying to hide who DJ's real father may be because he wants to keep DJ. Aw. I think was in her email. I think he truly fell in love with the baby and was maybe more upset than he realized he would be when he learned he wasn't the father. He also kept saying, don't read them about the journals, which I found surprising at the time. He wanted to respect Aaron's privacy because maybe he's feeling lots of guilt about everything, the way he treated Aaron, the catfishing possibly leading to her death, etc. I don't know if that is supported by this episode, though I think we still have a huge question mark about what Dylan is up to, even in this violent interlude that he has in this episode.
Yeah, I agree. I think his motivation is to keep custody of DJ. I don't know. That was my theory too. It still kind of is my theory. That being said, like, his interaction with Jess is just, I feel no awe about Dylan in any of this. Like, this guy sucks and should not have custody of that baby. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe there's some other big Dylan secret that, you know, could be revealed in those journals. But I think, and this is getting ahead of ourselves a bit, but I think, you know, what Jess plucked out of that journal is a photo, and that photo was connected to, like, the Ross family. So I don't think it's connected to Dylan, unless it's about paternity. That's the only secret I could see that he is hiding. Unless they're going to like introduce some third act Dylan twist, which I just don't think they have time for. You
know? And isn't the paternity issue, at least as it pertains to Dylan, already settled? Like, they know that he's not the father?
They know that he's not the father, but in episode 5, when he was talking to Brianna out on the porch, he was like, my parents are going to sort of try to get custody of the baby anyway. And she's like, even though he's not yours? And I think it's like, if they don't know who the father is and Aaron's dead and her dad Kenny's in prison, I think Dylan's family could make a reasonable bid for custody of the baby. But I think once it's known that, you know, the Rosses are involved, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. if I had to guess where that baby winds up, I'd say probably with Lori at the end of the day. But we'll see. But that would be my guess.
Yeah, so. That would be an interesting conclusion for poor Lori.
Poor Lori.
Okay, one more email to read, and then I think you might have another email to read.
I do.
So this is from Sarah, who writes, I don't feel equipped to succinctly address the bigger issue of how we should be talking about cop shows, but regarding whether or not Mare is a good cop, this is my take. I think we are shown in many ways that Mare is a good cop, and when I say good, I mean good as incompetent, not good in the moral sense. What Mare is not good at is handling her personal life. We are also shown this at multiple points throughout the show. So as far as the planting drugs incident goes, that is Mare making a very stupid personal decision. When it happened, I initially thought, come on, she can't be that stupid. But after thinking about it, I think we see her make a lot of poor choices regarding her personal life, while at the same time being an excellent detective. Again, I'm not commenting on her goodness or morality as a person, just on how she can be both good at police work and also make such a colossally stupid decision in her personal life. Yeah, I mean, I understand where Sarah's getting with that. And I think, yes, we have seen several examples almost in every episode where Mare has been good at investigative work, right?
Yeah.
But part of her job also is to not let personal life kind of come into it. So I think even if you're paring away the morality of it, like, she is bad at being a police officer because she's doing things like planting evidence and working a case when she's off duty, you know, or been removed from duty, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it's complicated. But I don't think the moral question, I think that's a separate thing in some ways, not always.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, honestly, I like Mare and I support Mare and I think she's on a real journey and I'm happy for her. And I honestly kind of think the whole drug planting thing was a narrative push to get her in therapy. Cause that seems to be sort of like the whole real thing of the series is like Mare needed some therapy. Do you know what I mean? But which I agree with and I'm glad she's getting, but I am a little uncomfortable with the fact that she's just let back on the force in this episode. Like, that just feels like, I'm glad Mare's on the case, but like, it feels a little consequence free to me. Does that make sense?
It does. And I think that the two things are unrelated. She planted drugs on the mother of her grandchild in completely illegal, immoral, whatever fashion.
Yeah.
And then she happened to be help sort of solve the case of who abducted the women, but she wasn't supposed to be doing that because she was removed from duty. Someone got killed. Well, two people, like, you know. And I don't know. I kind of think that, like, yes, she is sort of a hero, but I don't know if that would be enough to wash away everything else. You know, unless they were just trying to save face, like, oh, no, Mayor, no, she's not suspended. She's totally one of ours. Like, we're proud of her, you know, which could be the case, honestly.
And and that is in keeping with the way in which, you know, police watch out for police in general. The only, I guess, the consequence, like, because, you know, a lot of people are apologizing to Mayor, treating her like a hero in this episode. The consequence we do see is Colin's mother gives her not just one, but two slaps. The old double slap from Mrs. Abel. So, and then that's something that really, really profoundly affects Mare, and we'll talk about that. So there are some consequences there to everything that's been going on, but I hope it's an intentional commentary on the system of how easily Mare's, like, let back in. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
All right, this next message is a little, I don't quite know how to, like, preface it entirely, but we got a message
from a listener.
We got a message from a listener. They genuinely asked me to use their name, so I'm not name dropping. Mr. Damon Lindelof, who is the creator of Lost and The Leftovers and Watchmen, is an avid Mayor of Easttown watcher and has a theory, an alternate theory of the case, and would like us to read it, and asked that his name be attached to it. So here's my dramatic reading of Damon Lindelof's theory of the case of Mayor of Easttown. My favorite theory, he writes, is that Aaron was killed by Therese Cooley, the power forward from the 1994 championship game who was defending Mayor on the Lady Hawk shot. I'll continue, but only if you and Richard promise to read this next week and attribute it to me. Therese was in the gym night of the quote-unquote reunion. In the same way that Mayor has been celebrated for an iconic shot, Teresa, I think it's Therese. Is it T-H-E-R-E-S-E? Is that a Teresa or a Therese?
Therese. I don't know.
Therese?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I'm going to read it differently every time then. Therese has been reviled for not getting back on defense and giving Mayor the open look. It was all downhill from here. Bad relationships, bad jobs, bad everything. There was a scout there that night from UPenn. Therese had put up 18 points and 9 rebounds, but none of it mattered because it was all about fucking Lady Hawk. As Mayor hobbled out onto the floor that night, almost 30 years later, the cheers cascaded around Therese and it was then she decided something must be done. In truth, she had already begun to plot her revenge by getting Carrie sober and introducing her to the lawyer that would represent her in the custody battle to come, but that would not be enough. Therese had also been a regular at the poker game at Benny's bar. She heard the muffled clanks from below and saw the pipes move on occasion, but going to the cops would only relieve Mayor of the pain of an unresolved missing persons case, and that simply would not do. I know what you're thinking. Why Aaron? Well, for reasons Joanna has already spelled out for us, Aaron was at the center of a scandal that would not only completely destroy Mare's own family by implicating her ex-husband, but that of her best friend as well. Her best friend, Lori, who set the pick that allowed Mare to make the shot. As John's secret lover, Aaron's death would ruin them all. And so that night, after the rally, her neck hot and drunk on a 6 of Rolling Rock, Teresa texted Aaron and, well, the rest is sort of obvious. Here's the best part of my theory. Whatever the show does the next 2 episodes, whoever appears to be the murderer, just know that it was really Teresa executing the ultimate frame job. So that is Damon Lindelof's, his pitch for whodunit.
I think we're done. I don't think we need to do next week's finale episode.
Yeah.
I think that's it.
Right?
We'll just assume it's correct. You know, look, if someone can create The Leftovers, they got to be right about this. Oh, and Watchmen.
I mean,
and,
you know, here's what I would suggest: that HBO consider doing Teresa of Westtown season 2, starring, I have a few options here: Charlize Theron, Julianne Moore. Those are my 2 best bets.
Those are good bets.
Where we get sort of the whole season again, but from the other side.
Like the Twilight book, where it's from Edward's perspective.
I mean, exactly on par, comparable situation. Yeah. So, that is from Damon Lindelof. Thank you so much, sir, for listening to the show and for submitting that. And anyone else, if you have a theory that you want to bop in before the finale, please email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Probably by the time we get it, we will already know the ending. So, you know, bigger reactions to how you feel the whole season is going will be a better use of your time. And then before we get, no, let's go to our interview this week. We've got Robbie Tan, lovely, lovely fellow who has some great scenes in this episode, that he talks about here. It's a little bit of a complicated interview, of course, because I haven't seen the finale. He can't talk to me about the finale. This whole thing ends on a big cliffhanger where Billy is ostensibly still the suspect, but that's not a theory I believe. So you get to listen to this fun conversation where all of that is true.
And it was partly a complicated interview because you had driven him out to the country for ostensibly a weekend of fishing, right?
Sure.
Yeah,
but
so he was,
you know,
a little
as
on edge.
You know, and, yeah, as yeah. you know.
Never go to the countryside with Joanna. People should
Top gun in the tackle box. So, yeah. You know, classic me. All right. So here's our Riverside chat with Robbie Tan.
I'm Claire Fallon. And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
All right, we are so delighted to have Robbie Tan on the podcast. Robbie, how are you?
I am doing so good, Joanne. I'm so happy to be here with you today.
Excellent. We obviously want to talk to you about all things Billy Ross, but we also know that there's a lot you can't say because there's one whole more episode to go. So we're going to do our best to thread this needle and talk about what we can talk about today. Sound good?
All right. Let's do it. All yeah. Right. Sounds great. Yeah.
So let's start sort of at the beginning for you. When, you know, when you first hear about this role, when you're auditioning for this role, you know, how is Billy presented to you as a character?
That's a great question. So when I auditioned for this role, I didn't get the script. I was told it was, you know, like a recurring role, but I had no knowledge of what the role actually was. And actually, when I auditioned, I did the scene from episode 5 that just aired. And then I actually did, interestingly enough, I did Kenny McMenamin's scene in episode 2, where he's like Dylan Hinchy is the father. Mm-hmm. I did that scene because, you know, I think clearly there was a lot they were keeping under wraps at the time. So they gave me stuff from the show, but not necessarily anything like specific about the show. So when I didn't really learn anything about the role, like what it was, until after I got cast in it. So maybe this role, like I'm like, you know, holding coffee for some character for, you know, a few episodes. Like I just really had no idea what it was going to be. And then I got cast. And then obviously I found out more in depth what it was. And I was like, oh my God, like, I'm in the ship. You know what I mean? I was like, I'm in it. Like so.
Right. So episode 6, you know, this is going up after episode 6 and everyone will have seen episode 6. And you get to do just like a lot of juicy stuff in that episode. Like we said, this is a tricky situation. We got one episode to go from the end, but like, you know, how did your understanding of who Billy was and the depth of emotion you wanted to bring to that character, how did it evolve as you worked on the project?
To answer that question, I think that like what Brad does, and I think what makes the show work in the way that does, and something I think that I intuited even in reading that first scene, was that everybody in the town just has like a lot going on. Because Brad wrote all of these backstories for these characters that were just like super rich and super, you know, full of life. And so I had a lot to like kind of chomp my teeth into, even outside of just what was going on in the story itself. That's kind of like a vague way to explain like what it was.
So Billy, you know, Billy in this episode, I don't know that we knew this already about Billy, that he's like living with his dad. You know, we see him walk in with like a six pack or whatever, you know, like the characters always have like a rolling rock in their hand and stuff like that, you know? So like, you know, what can you tell us, if anything, of that that backstory that Brad created for Billy?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I don't know what's going to make it, because I haven't seen episode 6 also, but Billy's had some like tragedy happen in his life as well, particularly with family members in his life. And he's been sort of like wearing that underneath all of what's been going on. He's been wearing that also for quite some time. So when you know, the situation happens in the show, it kind of compounds with like this personal tragedy that Billy's also been experiencing over a few years. And I don't know if they get into it in episode 6 again, because I haven't seen it, of why he's living with his dad. I don't know if they talk about any of that, because also too, it's like, a lot of it, it's hard for me to know what got shaped out of what we shot because of COVID, you know, a lot of stuff kind of shifted and changed. And so ideas about characters and storylines that were there, like, might not be there, and like full on backstories, or like, do they allude to things? So there's, for me, it's actually interesting because I'm discovering it, what's in the show, as you're discovering it too. So, so that's been kind of, you know, an interesting thing too, to be like, oh, this is how they're shaping this, or this is how they're, the direction they're going with the character. This is what they're letting people in on or not letting them in on. But the personal tragedy aspect was something that Brad wrote in there. That is a big reason, you know, why Billy is so downtrodden. Yeah.
Downtrodden. What a perfect word for poor Billy Ross. Well, something that you know, talking to Craig, your ultimate director, and talking to Evan Peters a bit, this understanding of like how they dramatically sort of reshaped who that character was from an initial conception. And so you mentioned something sort of similar to that. Do you feel like Billy underwent some sort of overhaul in the COVID pause?
Yeah. There's stuff that, you know, storylines, and what the beautiful thing about what Brad did, and why I just love Brad as a writer, is he wrote out all of these stories, and they're all very, like, the backstories for all of these characters, you know, were so fleshed out. And then I think because of, you know, COVID, a lot of stuff had to kind of get cut away and reshaped. And I wouldn't say that Billy's been like heavily COVID like adjusted in any way. But there's definitely been like minor changes here and there, like little shifts, for sure. And I think for the better, like as I've been watching it, I've been like, it's been fun to be like, oh, that's been the decision that decision got made because it's setting this other thing up to be even more potent or be even more like, holy shit, that came out of nowhere. Definitely, right. There's been some shaping of like this mass of material, you know, pulling and being like, what's the most effective way to tell this story? And absolutely for me, and I think for the show in general, that's happened quite a bit.
So to overwrite, to overshoot, and then like find the story in the edit, almost like shape it in the edit kind of thing. Is that what you're saying?
I think so.
And then what can you tell me about, like, let's say for episode 6 specifically, even though you haven't seen it, for basically the plot that happens around episode 6, is that stuff you shot before the break or after the break? Do you remember?
So episode 6, so actually the end of episode 6, like going out into the woods and all that stuff, that was all right before, that was literally right before COVID, all of that stuff. And then the stuff that we shot, that's like the main substance of it, the scene with Joe Tippett and I, who, you know, plays John, I think it's, you know, like a, I would say like, you know, the big scene in episode 6. That was actually the last shot, scene in production.
Oh, wow.
The one where I'm drinking beers and, you know, the scene I'm talking. Am I being too vague?
No, I got you.
That was the last scene of production. And actually all of my stuff in episode 6 got shot, I think, in a single day, like me coming in the house, the big scene in that. And then so like that was after COVID though.
And what can you tell me about? Okay, so let's talk about that big scene as much as we can. You know, this is like a huge emotional place that you have to go into, and it's an emotional place also that has to hold some ambiguity for the viewer. And maybe that's just up to the edit. But like, my question is, like, what work did you and Craig do on that, or what was it like shooting the day? How many takes did you do? Like, how did you land that?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think like that's the beauty and the nature of like this kind of show. So like, it's inherently like, how do you play things that like really read and also can remain ambiguous. Mm-hmm. And definitely that's something that Craig was really, really great about. And Craig, I love the way Craig works because Craig likes to shoot several takes in different ways, because especially with a show that's like, it's a delicate balance, right? Like how people play scenes can tip the hand one way or the other about what things mean. And for Craig, he was always like, let's shoot it a bunch of different ways so we kind of don't back ourselves into a corner, so that we can kind of, you know, go back into the edit and find the balance that way. So for me as an actor, it was super fun because, you know, I got to do these scenes like five kind of different ways, you know, and throw in a little wrinkle every single time. And then like, that's also been fun too, to be like, oh, that's what they used. Oh, that's the take that they used. Like in episode five, like watching that particular take, I didn't necessarily think that was the one that was going to get used. Cause I think I remember at the time we were doing that scene and, Kate was like, Kate said something like, oh my God, it looks like you just shit yourself or something like that. And I was like, well, they're not going to use that one. And then I think that's the one that ended up getting put in the show. So it, absolutely, there's a delicate balance and Craig was very much like, let's get a bunch on tape and we'll make a decision kind of later.
So there's a version of that episode five scene when Billy gets like a fresh rolling rock and then decides to peace out, where Billy played it a little cooler than he did. Okay. I see.
Exactly. Yeah. Just like, all right, see you guys. Yeah, exactly.
Right. But they went for the shitting himself version. All right.
Exactly. Can I swear on this podcast? Yes, I don't know. Is that Okay.
All right. So, well, let's talk about Kate a little bit. So like, you know, Kate is obviously, you know, the titular mayor, the center of the show, but she's also, you know, an EP on the show. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you observed in terms of her being both performer and someone, you know, sort of helping to run the show.
Oh yeah. Well, I have to say, I mean, just to give you like an example of what she was like, I have so many amazing examples of her on set. But like you take for example, like Kenny McMenamin's scene when, you know, Patrick Murney, who was playing that role, was finding out that, you know, Aaron was dead. And the way that Kate, as both actor and executive producer, like that is an incredibly difficult scene. Like if that scene doesn't work, like, you know, that's like the crux of the show in many ways. And she just went out of her way in all the ways to give Patrick all the space in the world and make sure that he was taken care of on that day. Like she looked out for his performance in a way that I don't think many actors would, but certainly someone of her like stature and like, you know, she's done so much. She's, I mean, Kate Winslet. She was just always looking out for everyone. And I remember like my first day on set also, like it was, you know, really early in production. I got there, it was like freezing and like, you know, things weren't set up yet. So I kind of had nowhere to hang out. And I go in the dressing room and she's there and she's like, just go hang out in my trailer, you know? And I was like, I don't think I'm like, I don't like, that's very kind of you. You know what I mean? And she was just like that. And then she sat and we talked for like 20 minutes and she's just somebody who, you know, sets the tone and like takes care of everybody and you feel supported and everybody's doing great work because she is, just taking care of everybody. And she's incredibly smart and incredibly detail oriented and never cheats you, you know, in terms of like, she's been working day after day after day after day. And I show up on set, you know, after a few weeks and she's, you know, she's beyond where I'm at, you know, at that point in terms of energy. And like, so I have nothing but, incredible things to say about her in terms of being an actor and also somebody running the show. It was a special thing to watch.
And then what about Brad's level? You know, Brad obviously wrote everything. What was his level of involvement, you know, as production was rolling on?
He cares so deeply about it. And obviously because it's about a place that he was from and he was so personally invested, but Brad was very much like involved. And, you know, I would always be like, we would shoot something and I would always just want to know how he felt about it, because he was such a good barometer for, you know, if we were hitting, you know, hitting the mark, if we were doing justice to his vision. And he was always generous about it too. He would never make you feel like, oh, that wasn't quite it, or like that, this is, you know, you're doing a terrible job. He was always interested in helping out in a way that was like, let's just make it better. Like, what do you need? And that he is not a Hollywood guy. He is like, He is a real good guy. Yeah.
Do you feel like you got a note either from Brad or Craig or Kate or anyone that was like particularly helpful to you and in feeling like you can dig into who Billy is?
Not anything in particular, like not like a aha moment, but I think that his willingness early on to, like, we had, you know, some pretty significant conversations about, you know, the role and about the show, and that is, you know, not something that always happens, you know, especially TV and film. Like, you don't always get to go in there and do all this kind of, like, I guess you would say book work, or like, you know, actor work or circumstance work. Yeah. But he laid the groundwork and he was willing to do that with everybody. And that was helpful for me, because I didn't have to show up and go, hope I'm doing this right. Like,
something that the show does so well, and I just don't know how y'all did it, is it really feels like these are people who have known each other forever, right? Like, that there's so much unspoken history and so much intimacy, like, you know, scenes where the Ross family and like Mare are like hanging out together. It just feels like these are people who have sat in this room a million times to watch the game or whatever it is. Do you have any insight into sort of, as actors together, how you delivered that intimacy, as a director, how Craig made that work? Like, what do you think?
That's such a good question, because I think a lot of the times the, you know, supporting roles take their cue on what the style of the style of the piece is going to be, you know, based on who is at the top of the call sheet, right? And so I think that just knowing Kate was the lead of the show, it just kind of said, like, okay, everybody, or at least for me, like, this is the level and this is the kind of way you need to approach this. And that in that way is like natural, dropped in, real, like, nothing fake, nothing inauthentic in performance. Like, if you've been brothers with somebody or you've known somebody for 10 years, like, you better find a way to make that believable by, like, living with those circumstances in, like, a real way. So you walk on set and it feels like you've known each other for years. So just from the jump, knowing who was at the top of the call sheet was like, oh, this is the kind of project. This is the way I need to approach it. And then every day, I mean, you work with people. I very much followed the lead. You know, you work with, like, Julianne. And to even be in a scene with Julianne and Jean Smart, you know, I'm following their lead in a way. So, like, they're setting the tone in scenes like that. So I'm just like, okay, so we're going to do this in this sort of way. And I guess that's the best way I can put it. I follow their lead in how to approach the scene work.
Did you learn anything from, like, observing Jean Smart or Julianne Nicholson or?
Oh my God. Yeah. I think that, like, particularly with, yeah, I mean, they do such a, I think this is very much connected to the question you asked, which is like, they don't work hard as actors. Like, and that to me is something I really admire and have always aspired to get better at, is to not seem like I'm acting. And they have such a comfort level and ease in allowing themselves to be, you know, seen on camera, that to work with them is to get like a little bit of a key into how are they doing this, right? How are they actually pulling this off is super helpful for like me as an actor to go, oh, that's how they're doing it. And maybe one day I'll get to that level, but it was certainly helpful to see how it was happening.
Yeah. To your point about multiple takes, I loved something Craig told me. He was like, yeah, I would do all these takes with Jean. And then she would be like, can I just do one where I get to just be fucking funny? Like, can I just do the funny take also, you know?
Yeah.
He's like, sure.
Oh my God. She had me dying that scene where she's talking about Betty Carroll, like, you know, the Cheerios line. I mean, it was funny every time, every time. It was hysterical. She's amazing.
To that relationship question, the central one, it seems like for Billy is with John, with Joe Tippett's character. And, the HBO description for the John Ross character says like an unbreakable bond with his brother. So like, you know, what can you say about their relationship and how you cultivated that with working with Joe?
Well, what I'll say is that Joe and I got along really well. Like, we had a very good working relationship, and we both really cared a lot. I mean, it's a big deal for both of us, you know? So like, there was this sense, even from the first time I met Joe, that it was like, what are we doing? Like, what is this? In terms of the unbreakable bond thing, I mean, I think that there's like familial, I don't know, it's hard to say with that description and how HBO describes it, but I think that a big part of the show is like family. And like, for us, it was like, we're brothers. Like, we are like ride or die. Like, it's me and you. It's a big deal to both of us. Does that answer your question?
I think as best you can right now, it does.
Okay, good. Absolutely. Good.
All right. Well, I think we did it. I don't know what else we can say with one more episode to go. So I think we did our best. Thank you so much for the chat. I really appreciate it.
Oh, of course. Of course. I thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
All right, Richard, where do you want to start with this week's episode? Oh, should we start with the title of the episode?
Oh, yes. That is a good place to start.
Okay, so this, as we've noticed each week, the episodes mean something very specific. Craig Zobel, the director of all the episodes, told me that Brad Inglesby, the writer, picked all the titles and had very specific reasons why. So maybe that's a good question for an email. If you can piece together all the reasons why these various song lyrics and poem snatches are in here, let us know. But this one in particular, Sore Must Be the Storm, comes from an Emily Dickinson poem that reads as follows. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard the sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it in the chillest land and on the strangest sea, yet never in extremity it asked a crumb of me. So, Richard, any Dickinsonian analysis there?
You know, it's interesting. I took a class in college that was just, we read every single Emily Dickinson poem. And this is a pretty famous one. Hope is a Thing with Feathers, yeah. That term itself. I don't know. I think I'm kind of stuck on that could have bashed a little bird that kept so many warm. And I'm wondering, you know, there's so much in this show about care and familial stuff. And I don't know. I wonder if that's pointing us toward what we kind of get to at the end of the episode, that this is a very like close thing. This is in the family, you know? But that's my, I don't know. That's my best guess, I guess. But like also the stuff about hope, there is some hope, at least with, you know, these girls are returned to their families and things are looking, well, I mean, people are looking toward the future more than they have been, I suppose. But yeah, I don't know. I'm sort of stuck on that one line about the little bird that kept so many warm.
Yeah, I just watched The Thin Red Line, completely unrelated. I just watched The Thin Red Line again for, I don't know, the seventh time. It's a film I really love. And, you know, it's a war film set in the Pacific Theater of World War II. And there's just all these shots of, like, you know, because it's Terrence Malick, like waving grass and nature. And there's like a shot, there's this one long shot of like this wounded baby bird on the ground that it's like, you know, you're meant to think about, you know, the destruction of war and nature and all this sort of stuff like that. And it invokes that for me. I guess how I would interpret it is, even though things are awful, there's this ticking bomb at the center of Mare's life, which is, you know, the Ross family revelation, whether it's Billy or John, and we'll talk about that. Like, it, you know, there's something big about to explode in Mare's life. However, I think we can see from this episode that she is the best position than she's ever been in her life, I think, to handle it, because of the therapeutic work she's doing. And I think you see that in the conversation she has with Frank about Carrie. And in the conversation she has with Siobhan, where I think she's just really like trying to heal, you know, buried wounds, or and in being that emotionally healthy despite all this awful stuff that's going on, like, her way forward is a more hopeful one than it was when we first met her.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah. You know, I'm looking at the episode titles because I was thinking about them in aggregate.
Yeah.
And I kind of want to take a little credit away from Damon Lindelof, because episode 7 is called Teresa Did It. So, I don't know. Maybe that's like an allusion or something to something else, but like, I don't know.
All right. So let's start with Siobhan here in this episode. Honestly, this is my biggest confusion point for the episode, because I just don't know that I see the seeds that were planted that bloomed in this episode in terms of Siobhan coming completely unraveled. Really quickly, because like Siobhan, it's okay. I think the story of a younger sibling of a troubled, you know, young man who has had to be the grown up and has had to be sort of the type A, hold everything together person, who is very successful and all that sort of stuff like that. I think the story of her unraveling is a really powerful one. I just needed to see like at least one thread go a little looser before this episode. What do you think?
I agree. Yeah. And there's something I like about this and something I really don't like. The one thing I really don't like is that we have Mare have this conversation with her therapist about finding her son's body.
Yeah.
And that Siobhan was the one there first on the scene. And then we have Siobhan drunk and saying to her mom, yelling at her mom about exactly that. And it's just like, that is too much of a narrative coincidence. That is
exactly
kind of just too tidy writing. I think there would have been a way to locate that particular pain within Siobhan without having her explicitly reference something that Mare has just talked about a few scenes previous. You know, that bothered me.
Yeah.
Something I do appreciate, I guess, about Siobhan's kind of psychological mapping in this episode is the moment when Anne and Siobhan are talking about Siobhan's future and flying out to Berkeley and all that stuff. And Anne says, you know, something along the lines of, to have it, it doesn't have to last in order to mean something, right?
Yeah.
But Siobhan's entire, as we see it on the show, her entire outlook on familial love, on love in of community, is you stay, you stick around. That presence is the foundation for all of that. It's the proof of it, right? So it's a terrible violation that her brother chose to leave the world. And now Anne is saying, like, well, you know, some things are impermanent and you can go, and there's, like, you know, people can keep moving. And I think in Siobhan's mind, that can't possibly be true, you know, because if that were true, then what is everyone doing in Easttown? Like, what, like, isn't the whole point that you stick around, that you're loyal, dedicated, you're there, not just in emotional ways, but in physical ways for each other. And to have that kind of, have this outsider just be like, no, like, love works in all different kinds of ways. And, you know, and to almost advocate for a little bit of not selfishness, but sort of independence and all that. That I can believe really unmooring Siobhan from her understanding of, like, how human relationships are supposed to work.
That's a good point. I mean, I think something that I have loved about Siobhan is this inversion of the classic story of, you know, a character like Siobhan in a different story would be dying to get out of Easttown and doing anything. But, like, we've seen in previous episodes, Mare sort of being like, what's going on with your college applications? Like, where are you going? What are you doing? Like, I sent you to a good school so that you could, you know, have a better life, you know, and Siobhan sort of stubbornly clinging to Easttown. And I like that about her. And so, like, you know, this whole idea of Berkeley, I think, is unmooring for her. The way in which, yeah, I think that moment with Anne, her girlfriend, was, like, is the key. It just, yeah, there's just something missing connective tissue wise for me, but a great performance, good scene. Love to see Mare in a healthier place, you know, sort of saying I'm sorry to her daughter and not, you know, trying to connect with her daughter rather than just be like, you're in a lot of trouble sort of thing, right? Like, the last time Siobhan was in trouble, Mare just said something like, I'm so mad at you right now, you know, and stormed out. And this is very different from that. So speaking of mothers and kiddos, let's talk about Carrie. Like, the thrust of, I mean, I think I see very clearly what they're setting up here for Carrie. I'll be curious to hear what you think. But, like, we see Carrie is stretched thin. She's working a lot. She's saying no to drugs. As far as we've seen, you know, we're meant to think that Drew almost drowned in the bathtub. Which was literally Helen's warning. I don't think that we needed that literal warning, but that's what we got. So what do you feel like is going on here with Carrie?
Well, I think that she is realizing that there is a difference between being sober and being ready to be a full-time parent and a sole parent, a single parent, you know. Yeah. I don't think that,
yeah,
you know, I know there's a fear shared by Mare's family that, like, if Carrie gets custody, that's it. Like, she's gone, the kid's gone. I don't know if Carrie sees it that way, but I think what this episode does is probably push her closer towards, like, okay, we need to organize some sort of co-parenting thing because I can't do it. And I think the moment in the tub, I was like, you better fucking not show. Like, you better not do anything like this. And they didn't. And I think that what that was getting at was that, like, there are, I mean, I'm not a parent, but I can imagine, I have spoken with friends who are parents, that, like, there are myriad times throughout any day or week or month or whatever where there's that sudden horrible jolt of fear and, like, you think something has happened and then, oh no, it's okay, you know. But, like, you, that doesn't mean that you don't have to be vigilant. And I think that Carrie realizing, and it's not really her fault, she's working two jobs, her hours are insane, she's in recovery.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the show is making a social point in that way, you know, like, if only she had better resources. But it's also a personal thing to carry where it just would be like, I want to do this, but I also need help. And so much of this show is about people seeking help from family, from community. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, something about it, about these scenes with Carrie, led me to hope, like, you know, the poem or something, that storyline is headed somewhere happy-ish.
I completely agree. I think that what we're going to see in the finale, in the final moments of the show or something like that, is I would predict Carrie either moving into Mare's house or like into Frank's house around the back. Because, I mean, I don't know if Mare has an extra room, maybe if Siobhan ends up leaving for college or something like that, but like having Carrie there, you know, and like getting the help she needs, then she probably only has to work one job. And, you know, Drew can be, and then Mare doesn't have to lose Drew, but not, in, but Mare can have Drew around, but not in a way that like deprives Carrie of him. That's like a really happy ending for that scenario. And I think that's what they're setting up in this episode. That's what I think.
Yeah.
We'll see. And I thought, how do you pronounce the actress's first name? Soshi Bacon? Kevin Bacon's daughter? Kira Sedgwick's daughter?
Soshi?
Yeah. I thought she's really good in this. Like, I thought the bathtub scene was like a little like, please don't try to make me think that you're going to drown a kid in this really already really bleak show. But I thought her reaction, like, I just think she's really natural with that kid. And I thought her reaction to panic and stuff like that was really, really well done too. All right, let's talk about Freddie and Beth and Dawn, who, you know, are these sort of satellite characters to the story. You know, Dawn gets her kid back and she apologizes, or thanks Mare at least. And then Freddie ODs, and, you know, and Beth had said earlier in the season that was something that she kind of, you know, was hoping for, which sounds awful, but like, you know, she's just like, I don't know what else to do. Like, so it's like, it's a complicated moment for her because she's devastated and relieved at the same time. How do you think, you know, this feels like a wrapping up of those storylines. Like, we won't see them in the finale necessarily. Like, how does all that work for you?
Yeah, it's a wrapping up. It's also a, you know, very sad and resigned gesture toward, you know, so many real life deaths. And I think that Mare going into the house and finding him dead and just being like, well, okay, you know, I think that that sort of, it's not insensitivity, but just this is par for the course for a lot of first responders in so many towns across the country, you know, like, oh, another day, another overdose. You know, it's all too common. And I think that as much as Freddie was an emblem of something larger, this may have been the only way for it to end. Although, you know, we see it continuing on in a different way. We see it with Missy and Katie. You know, they detox in a very horrible way. But, you know, I think that the show, unfortunately for Freddie, had to acknowledge the reality that most of these opioid addictions do end in death.
Yeah, and I think what you mentioned a couple episodes back was really, you know, important to hold on to, this idea of like, you know, who is the villain of this story, right? And like, we'll talk about maybe a literal answer to that, but like the opioid crisis or the drug crisis. And like this really sad thing about Freddie. And once again, I like that something that Robbie Tan said in his interview is that Brad Inglesby wrote like complex backstories for every single character, right? So every single character, you know, Beth and Dawn and whatever, they all have like a lot of information. Those actors have a lot of information to play off of. And with Freddie, I mean, it's a small detail, but like, he's got a kid, and like the first time that they go into that house, which is, you know, in the first episode when Mare's chasing him and his heat has been turned off, like there's photos of his kid on his fridge, and like his family left him. But that's just so sad. Like, I mean, it's sad no matter what, but it's that little detail of like, and he's got a family. And they just can't support him anymore in this. But, you know, what was lost is not just, you know, this man's life, but that kid lost a father as well.
I shouldn't say most, by the way. Many opioid addictions end in death. I don't know the statistics, but many do.
Let's talk about the Dylan and the Deacon and Jess.
That's a great play from the 70s. It's kind of a sex farce.
I think that's Dylan and Deacon and Jess.
And Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. Yeah. Long title.
Let's get the Deacon out of the way. I think Mark, we were right to sort of believe what he was saying. He gets arrested in this episode, but I think he's going to be released pretty soon. We did get one email from a listener. It's okay that we didn't read it, I think, but like, who, you know, we had said we kind of liked that the question of what happened at the deacon's previous, is it parish? I don't know what it is for a deacon, was left ambiguous. And one of our emailers said that they would have preferred it be confirmed one way or another, that they thought the story would be more interesting if it wasn't ambiguous. Maybe Brad Inglesby wrote that in the backstory that he gave to that actor, and he knows whether or not what happened there, but we may never know. But I that feels like the deacon story wrapped up. Is there anything you want to say about Father Red Herring, as some people are calling him?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. How annoyed are we supposed to get about red herrings on shows like these? Like, they need them, you
totally.
Know?
Yeah, yeah.
That actor whose name is not in front of me, James McArdle, he's really good. He was so good in the Angels in America revival that was in London and then moved to New York. He played the lead, essentially. Well, not Pryor, but Lewis. You know, anyway, I think that this is where it had to end, and clearly the show is saying, like, this halo of suspicion will follow him for the rest of his life, you know.
Give it up to Deacon Mark. He did not rat out the pizza joint kids who beat him up, said he fell on his face many
times.
Well,
pizza joint kids are they brutal reprisals.
They will mess you up if you rat on them. Yeah. All right. So, I mean, we already talked about Dylan. Is there anything more you want to say about Dylan and Jess here?
I don't know what the hell's going on. You know, I thought that the sort of thriller scene where she's hiding under a car and, you know, like, I don't know what to make of this, to be honest, because it feels like so much of the rest of this episode is pointing us very heavily in the Ross direction. That I'm not sure this, you know, I don't know. There's something about it that reminded me. Have you ever seen the movie Bully, the Larry Clark movie? Yeah. That kind of just like teenagers being incredibly violent with each other and threatening. And you kind of, it can be all too easy to forget the older you get that there is this kind of interior world full of its own law in a way that young people can have. Especially ones like left to their own devices as often as these kids are. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a pretty scary depiction of that, but it felt pretty sensational given everything else that happens in this episode. So I'll be curious to see where that's all headed.
Yeah. I also have questions about, like, there's this line earlier in the season where Zabel says, the only person with a registered gun in town is Kenny, which is wild to me. Like, this seems like a place where there would be maybe more registered gun owners. But like, what? Why is that line even there? Because what does it mean? Because we've seen several guns now. Don has a gun. Dylan has a gun. You know, like there's this gun in the tackle box. Like I've.
Drew has a gun.
Yeah, Baby Drew is a bathtub gun. So yeah, it's I have a lot of questions about that. Okay, the next topic here is Mare's guilt and therapy and Guy Pearce, I guess. So we've talked about this a little bit already, like Mare's in therapy. We get the whole story of what happened with Kevin that day in flashback. Another moment for Kate Winslet to really shine as she has in these therapy scenes, or that other earlier scene with the sort of child specialist talking about her son and sort of staring into the middle distance and making me feel things, like, especially when she said, like, the EMTs had to pull me off of him. And like, it's such a evolution of this character who, when we meet her in the first couple episodes, she is so clamped down, locked down, you know, like tough, brittle, funny. And here, like, all the pain is sort of spilling out. One of the things I really loved the most actually was the scene where she comes back from getting slapped by Zabel's mom, and Helen is there and asks how it goes, and Mare just cries and Helen hugs her. And like, given what we learned about Helen and Mare's dad and the way that like Helen felt about, we don't talk about mental health and stuff like that. Like that felt very powerful to me in that moment. What do you think?
I love the little shorthand of how to go, because it's Inglesby being, you know, showing the unseen life of these conversations and these people. Clearly, Mare and Helen had a conversation. I'm going to go. to Colin's mom's house. Right. And then she's kind of waiting up to find, you know, I love the, it's just one of the ways that this show just gets the sort of intimate texture of family life really correct. And I believe that she would come home and sob in her mother's arms after that, you know? Mm-hmm. And yeah, I don't know. I guess I don't fully get where Colin's mom's coming from. She's obviously just grieving.
Yeah.
But like, he would have gone anyway, you know, like it's not Mare's fault, but she's an easy person to blame, I suppose.
Well, something that Craig Zobel said to me in a conversation, I think after you and I had recorded our podcast last week, I asked him about why that audio of Kevin sort of played over at the end of episode 5 when Zabel's dead on the ground and Mare is sort of sitting there. And I think, you know, what he said is like, you know, Mare is connecting her guilt over Colin to her guilt over Kevin, that, you know, she feels very similarly guilty about these two young men, and that he saw this series as basically about Mare going through whatever therapeutical process she needs to go through, and in doing so, it will help her solve whatever the case is. That solving the case is only accomplished if Mare can, like, push through her own, you know, emotional blockages. I've yet to see the direct connection there, but, you know, I have faith that all will be revealed in the finale. But so I think, you know, Mare definitely sees herself in this woman who is in that brittle, angry at the world spot that we kind of met Mare right. in earlier. And that she's like, I can take that from her because I know what she's feeling. So Mare makes this other, you know, mentally healthy choice, perhaps, to press pause on her relationship with Richard, the author, Guy Pearce, who brings her a lovely gift basket. Our colleague Julie Miller, I was talking to her about like how we'd cover this episode. She's like, should I do a deep dive investigation to the gift basket? Which is such a Julie Miller question to ask. And I was like, yes, please. Mm-hmm. Something mm-hmm. I've heard a lot of.
Price it out.
Exactly.
Package it.
Something I've heard a lot of questions about is why the show is so focused on Rolling Rock beer when a lot of folks from that area, I've been told, drink Yuengling. So anyway, if you have local Delco beer opinions on whether or not Rolling Rock is the beer of choice, let me know. I liked this scene with Guy Pearce. I like this very mm-hmm. healthy choice that she's making here for herself. I got to work on me. I like him being like, I'll probably be around. He's like, I'm a 50s guy living in, you know, East Town. I was like, yeah, but you look like Guy Pearce. So I think you'll be fine. Anyway, and I would not be surprised if we don't see Richard again. I don't know. It feels like a lot of things are being tied up with a bow in this episode. What do you think?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, Mare saying that to Richard and being honest with him about like going on the date with Colin and everything mm-hmm. Does mirror in a little bit perhaps the dawning realization that Carrie's having, which is like, okay, I need to tend to some things, you know. I think it's about people not realizing priorities, but sort of listening to themselves and observing what's around them and being like, okay, this is the amount of stuff that I can handle right now. And everything else might have to kind of wait or, you know, be done in a different way. And so I think, yeah, I think it was a very, like you said, healthy thing that happened in that scene. And I would not be surprised if that is a wrap on Richard.
And it's so funny because I've been talking to a bunch of people who are not like, you know, as deep as we are because they don't host a weekly podcast about the show. And they're all like still stuck on like, it has to be Guy Pearce. Why else is he in the show? I was like, guys, I explained that in episode 1. It was a recast. Mm-hmm. Like Guy Pearce is here as a favor. And I think still a lot of people are going to walk away from, if he doesn't show up in the finale, a lot of people are going to walk away from this still just going like, why was Guy Pearce in this show to do that? Really?
Well, he lives in East Town Township.
Oh,
so
okay.
He was just there.
He was there and he just took working for Rolling Rocks.
He's an acting professor at a local college.
He had one great acting professor book and now he's, yeah. Anyway. All right. So let's wrap up with the Rosses. Richard, what do you think is going on here? What's your assessment?
All right. So you wrote something on the site about your grand unified theory of John being the villain,
right?
Or the killer.
Yes.
I agreed with you when you brought it up to me initially last week. I now agree with you more. I think that this show, this episode is setting it up so much to look like John is going to go out and maybe kill Billy to sort of spare the family from shame. And clearly it's Billy. He confessed, blah, 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 blah. I don't think that's actually what's happening. I think that Billy has agreed to lie for John for some reason. I don't know what that might be.
Yeah.
And John doesn't trust him to maintain the lie.
Correct.
You know?
Yes.
So I think that John is going to be our ultimate evil. I don't know where the Ryan of it all comes in. Did he see John with this woman, Sandra, I believe her name was? I think he did. So I think that's actually kind of unrelated and sort of like I think I said last week that Laurie is like, that was the big secret. And then her head is going to be turned mightily. It already has been in this episode.
Yeah.
Toward actually what's the big secret.
I rewound like 3 times watching Julianne Nicholson just go, Billy?
Yeah.
I just love her. Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
I also wanted to say briefly that I really, again, love the care the show took to do this mattress scene with the Ross's dad. And you get this window into his life. He's like, I didn't think I'd be spending my retirement, you know, bunked up with my adult sons. Like, and he's weary and they're concerned clearly about his health. And like, I just think the show is, you know, demonstrating yet another way, like all of the family networks in this and how people care for each other and how that can be exploited, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that giving us this kind of late in the game introduction to the Ross's interior family life outside of Lori's household was really valuable. And I think well done.
Yeah. And I don't know if like, I'm trying to understand the piece of evidence that this is like a retired cop's gun. And I'm like, is their dad a retired? I was like scouring the edges of frames to see if there was like some indication that this guy was a retired cop, that he like worked with Mary's dad or something like that. Like, I don't know where this gun came from and why it's important that it's a retired cop. That's a big question mark I still have at the end of this. Yeah, I think it was Billy. I think if you watch the episode thinking that John is guilty, there are so many moments where he's just looking shifty and squirrely as people are asking him questions. My favorite exchange actually, because they're trying so hard to make something read two ways, right? So like when John's dad says, asks if he had an affair, and John says, Lori thinks I had an affair. And then his dad asks for clarification and John just doesn't say anything in a way that like you could be like, oh, he feels guilty, ashamed of what he did. Or like, Lori thinks I had an affair, but that's not really what's going on. And then Billy comes in and he's so mad and he's like, take responsibility for once in your life. And you think he's talking about the affair, but I think he's really angry about this other thing. Because my belief is that something went wrong. With Aaron reaching out to John saying, I'm going to tell everyone you're the father of my baby, because she realized that Dylan is like not someone she wants her baby around. Right. She's like, I'm going to tell everyone. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if John's the one who convinced Aaron that she should say Dylan was the father in the first place. And I also wouldn't be surprised. I don't know how dark the show is going to go, but I wouldn't be surprised if Billy was also abused by John growing up. There is this like, if you like this trembling, dependent fear posture that Billy has with John, where it's like, how did John treat Billy as they were growing up? Because if he's like whispering to his young son and during a blackout, like, this is just our secret. And if he had sex with his like sort of niece when she was like 16 or whatever, like, this is a guy who I think has been abusive to people younger than him his whole life. That's who I think John Ross is. And like Lori even says, Lori's like, you know, talking about the affair, and Mare's like, you know, he's just going to put on the charm and you're going to take him back again. And Lori gets defensive about it. But like, that's just who John Ross is, a manipulator. That's who he is. That's who he's always been. That's what I think. And so I think the show is trying to make us think that Billy put that gun in the tackle box and that Billy is out there. But like, I think John put the gun in the tackle box and Billy discovered it.
Yeah, and then, that's what I think.
Yeah, and then John was like, hey, can you hand me the box? And Billy's like, no, I got it. Because he knows that like John is either going to try to make it look like he killed himself or kill him or something like that. Because he doesn't – exactly what you said, Richard, that he doesn't trust that Billy will lie effectively.
Yeah, and I think that, you know – if all of these theories that we have pan out, like, I think the portraiture there is that John is like a sociopath.
Yeah.
And I think that the tragedy of that would be in the show's broader kind of look at family is that, like, yes, family, you know, a loving family can be incredibly valuable for support and for humor and for, you know, all the stuff of life, but it can also hide a lot, and it can be protective in a very bad way. And I think that sort of duality, showing us the good and the bad, would sync up with the show's kind of ambivalent look at this town and these people.
And, like, I don't know what this is going to do to the Laurie, because there is a little tension between Laurie and Mare in this episode when Laurie's like, I don't want to talk about my family. Like, is, like, because what I think, right, is that Jess has brought in a photo. The photo that Jess brings in implicates John. That's what I think. Right. That, like, when Mare's right, boss yeah. is like, get Mare on the phone right now. It's because it's not Billy, it's John. Right. Mare's right. walking into a situation where she thinks she knows what's going on. I wouldn't be surprised if Billy, maybe Mare's going to shoot Billy because she thinks he's guilty and he's got a gun on John and she thinks Billy is the guilty one. She shoots, like, that's a tragedy I could see happening. Like, mm-hmm. maybe all of that goes down and she doesn't find out in that moment by the riverside, like, that it was actually. Who knows how it's all going to unfurl, but there's a real possibility, because she's not waiting for backup, that things are going to go very, very badly in a way that I hope does not, but could drive a wedge between Laurie and Mare. And Laurie, who has been, like, the one person who wouldn't let Mare push her away in all of this, you know?
Yeah.
We're hoping for a big scene for Julia Nicholson, the great Julia Nicholson, when she finds out. We've mentioned a Broadchurch a couple times. There is a tremendous, without spoiling season one of Broadchurch, which has been out for a very long time, so long it had a shitty American remake already. But there's an opportunity for Olivia Colman at the end of that first season, which was a big part of, I mean, I think she'd already won a couple BAFTAs at that point. She was sort of already on a roll, but, like, I think it was a big part of getting a lot of people to notice what Olivia Colman could do. And so I'm hopeful that the show gives an opportunity like that to Julia Nicholson next week. That would be great.
Yeah.
What else are you hoping for in the finale, Richard?
I'm hoping for a measured sense of closure. You know, I hope, I don't think, given what everything the show has done for us, that everything's going to be wrapped up in a neat bow. But I expect, and I am looking forward to, in a strange way, a sense of ambiguity in a lot of this, you know, that, like, where little bits of progress are made, little bits of happiness are found, but a lot else still hangs in the air. I think that the show has been very, for the most part, well calibrated on that front, you know, not leaning too hard into drama, into whatever. So that's what I hope. I hope that, like, things are resolved satisfyingly, but the show gives us a sense that, like, life very much in all the good and bad continues on for these people afterward.
I love that. All right. I have big hopes. Like, I don't need to be surprised by the finale because I feel very confident that I know what's going on. So I want to be emotionally satisfied by the finale. That's what I want.
Yeah.
And what you're describing is that. So I'm looking forward to hopefully getting some emotional satisfaction.
Maybe I want Siobhan to go to Berkeley or to get on a plane, you know, very, like, end of 6 Feet Under.
Yeah.
Driving away, see a song plays, you know.
You can't take a photo of Easttown. It's already gone, Siobhan. All right. Okay. Until we see Siobhan pack up and go to school, Richard, where can folks find you?
Well, our colleague Julie Miller has me packing Hoagie Rolling Rock gift baskets all weekend. So if she lets me have a break, 5 minutes even, I'll be tweeting at Rylaws, publishing on VF.com. Joanna, until the end of Easttown, where can people find you?
Oh my God, such a taskmaster, Julie Miller. You will find me. I have to go through the initiation process to join the Pizza Joint Kids gang.
Oh, you're getting jumped into the pizza gang?
Yeah, it's a lot of hazing, a lot of sausage and pepperoni. So we'll see how it goes. When I'm not doing that, you can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can find both of us on VF.com and also on the podcast Little Gold Men. And we will be back for the end of it all next week. Bye.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.